Hi everyone, and welcome back to the 11th video of the Old Testament Survey course. In the previous sections, we looked at the prehistory section of Genesis. And now, in this section, we'll look at the patriarchs period of the book of Genesis. Just like we'll do with all of the Old Testament books, we'll look at some background information, the organization of the book, the content of the book, and then some theological themes. The patriarch's epic is described in chapters 12 through 50 of the book of Genesis. Therefore, let's start by reviewing where we left off the prehistory of the earlier chapters of Genesis. Remember this cycle from the prehistory? God's grace, then human sin, then punishment, and then God gives new grace and hope. Now, I hope that you notice these as you work through the prehistory. But now I'd like to point out that in the Tower of Babel story in Genesis 11, it had sin and it had punishment, but there was no word of grace in that story. Or was there? Think about it. What was the next thing after the punishment of the Babel story? God's word of grace is the Toledot of Shem and the Toledot of Terah. Because both these two genealogies point to Abraham. You see, starting with Genesis chapter 12 is God's solution, not just for the Tower of Babel, but for all of human sin and brokenness. God chose one man and his family to work through to bless the entire world. So starting with Genesis 12, this is God's final plan, which breaks the cycle of sin and punishment. It started with Abraham, climaxed in Jesus, and is still being worked out and applied in us. Therefore, Abraham, one man, he has tremendous impact on history. One man can have an earth-shattering influence when God is at work in his life. So there's no limit to what God can do through you. And it started with Abraham and God's promise to him. God's promise was to Abraham and through him to all nations. And this promise was given, protected, and ultimately fulfilled. So let me remind you of the alternate way that we can divide history. Genesis chapters 1 through 11. The prehistory describes humanity's problem, which spirals down into depravity. And then Genesis chapter 12 through Revelation 22 describes God's solution. And this solution is worked out over centuries. In other words, God's solution to humanity's problem starts with Abraham and came to completion in Jesus. Therefore, the transition between Genesis chapter 11 and chapter 12, between the prehistory and the patriarchs, it's a monumental transition. And that's where this section begins. But first, let's look at a bit of some background issues, even though most of the background we've already covered. First, let's address the relationship of the patriarchs to history, the historical location of these stories. Now, we don't have any direct archaeological evidence of the patriarchs themselves, but that's not really an issue. You see, nomadic herders don't leave behind cities and permanent artifacts, and therefore we shouldn't expect to find them. However, the patriarch stories fit very well with what we know about this period and this place. The cities, the cultures with which they interact are well attested in history. This was a time of nomadic pastoral living, following flocks of animals to different pastures, but it was also the time of small city-state kingdoms. And let me give you a reminder of the physical location of the patriarchs. The patriarch story is basically a tour of the Fertile Crescent. From Mesopotamia to the Promised Land, down to Egypt, back to the promised land, and back to Egypt. So now let's look at the outline, the organization of the patriarch section. This epic is organized around the major stories of four generations of patriarchs. The first generation is the story of Abraham. And then the second is the story of Abraham's son, Isaac. And then the story of Isaac's son, Jacob. And then the story of Jacob's 12 sons, concentrating mostly on his son, Joseph. But I want you to notice that during the Joseph story, there's a parallel story that highlights his brother, Judah. So there's a lot going on in each generation, but the overall outline is fairly simple around these four names, with the fifth name sharing the spotlight in the fourth section. Now, we'll focus most of our attention on the content of the patriarch story. First, some general observations, what we should be looking for in all the generations. Keep your eye out for a few patterns that we'll see as we work through these chapters. The thread that runs through the entire story, and I would argue through the entire Bible, is the promise. God makes a promise to Abraham that is then passed down to his descendants. This promise is given, but then the promise is questioned because it's tested. You see, the promise does not immediately come to pass. And so the patriarchs were regularly tempted to doubt because they didn't yet see it. And also, I'd like you to notice, throughout this section, there's a main plot, but it's surrounded by many subplots and side characters that in one sense might look like an unrelated tangent. But I want to point out that a lot of these side characters and subplots, they are told for contrast. That is, sometimes the characteristics or actions of characters are highlighted by their similarities or differences from the experiences of others. And then finally, pay attention to how some of the characters, they try to help the promise to come about. Sometimes their help is helpful, but sometimes their help is counterproductive. Now let me try to map just a little bit more specifically Abraham's journeys. The story starts with him in the city of Ur in Mesopotamia, probably the place where he was born. But God appeared to him, spoke to him from Ur, called him to leave his homeland and travel to the land that would be given to him. So he travels up Mesopotamia to the city of Haran, where he stays for a while. Then God calls him further, and he travels through the promised land, staying briefly, and he ends up in Egypt. And then he travels back from Egypt and spends most of his life in the promised land, never actually owning any place except for a small plot for a burial ground. He lived as an alien and a stranger in the land that God had promised he would eventually give to his descendants. So Abraham basically walks the entire Fertile Crescent, and later his descendants will kind of follow that path in reverse. They will live in Egypt for a while and then return to the promised land. And later, they'll be conquered by Babylon and taken back to Mesopotamia. So now let's look at some key verses from the patriarchs. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3 says, "The Lord had said to Abram, 'Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. This is the initial call and promise that God gave to Abraham. And this promise is the means of God's universal plan to spread his blessing to every nation. And this is eventually fulfilled in Jesus. Now we'll come back and look a lot more detail at these verses a little bit later. But next is chapter 15, verses 5 through 6, which says that God took Abraham outside and said, "Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them." And then he said to him, "So shall your offspring be." And Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. Now, there are two main thoughts I want to point out in these verses. The first is God's promise to make Abraham, who at this time was childless, but God promised to make him into a great nation through his numberless descendants. And the Jewish ethnic group is actually the fulfillment of this promise, as all ethnic Jews trace their heritage back to Abraham himself as their forefather. And the second idea in these verses is Abraham's faith. Abraham trusted God when he made these promises, even though he didn't yet understand or see how this would be. And this trust was accounted by God to Abram as righteousness. And the New Testament, especially Paul, references this verse, references Abraham's trust as the pattern for those who trust in Jesus and thereby receive righteousness from Christ. The primary requirement God has for his people is for us to trust him and trust his word. And the last key verse is chapter 50, verse 20, in which Joseph is speaking to his brothers who had sold him into slavery, and he said to them, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." This highlights that God was always in control, always protecting and working out the fulfillment of his promise, even when circumstances and human agents seem to work against it, seem to say that the promise will never happen. But God was in control of every situation, and he was actually using them to bring about what he had planned all along. These are a few of the main ideas from the story of the patriarchs. So now let's look in more detail at some of the sections. As I mentioned earlier, it starts at the beginning of chapter 12 with God calling Abraham and giving him tremendous promises. Now we are introduced to Abram, as he was first known, as the climax of the genealogies in chapter 11. And now he becomes the focus of the story. Why Abraham? Why this one guy instead of all the many other people at the time? Well, I don't know. It was God's choice. Not because Abram was more or less righteous than anyone else. We're not told that. See, Abram was a pagan until God called him, apparently. But God chose one man for a special mission to bless the world. And God called him and gave him promises of blessing. And it was a promise of scrub, the first beginning of God's rescue operation for humanity. And as I've already mentioned, this promise comes in chapters 12, verses 1 through 3, which we've already seen. But let's break down these verses into the specific ideas that God spoke to Abraham. First, God commanded Abram to leave his home and people, to travel to a place that God would show him. He didn't yet give him the details. He just said, basically, "Start walking, and I'll lead you, and I'll let you know when you're there." But then he said, I will make you into a great nation. God will make a nation out of the descendants of a man who didn't have any children yet. And then God promised, I will bless you. God promises to do good to Abraham in ways that he has not yet defined, but it will be good. Then he says, I will make your name great. Now I want you to contrast this with back in chapter 11, verse 4. Remember the people of the Babel story, it said they wanted to make their name great by building a tower to heaven. Well, how did it work out for them? Is their name famous? Do you know any of their names? But by contrast, have any of you ever heard of Abraham? Of course you have. He's a major character of the Bible. You see, what they tried to get by rebellion, they didn't get. But Abraham received it by trusting and obeying God. By God's grace, Abraham's name is great. And then God told Abram, you will be a blessing. You see, God's promise of blessing was not just for Abram, not just for his family, not for selfish purposes. And this is the same is true for us. God's blessings for us are not just for us, but they should also spill over to the people around us. God blesses us to bless others through us. And I'm not just talking money. I'm talking everything. God says, I will bless those that bless you and curse those who curse you. You see, God's work through Abram actually divides humanity. There is no neutral ground. Everyone is either on board with what God is doing, or they are resistant to it. And everyone receives the just recompense with how they deal with God's plan and program. And finally, God says, every tribe of the earth will be blessed through you. Remember that God's intention is universal blessing to every people group in the world. And we see the result of this in Revelation chapter 7, where we see a numberless multitude from every tribe, nation, people, and language worshiping around God's throne. But it all starts with one man. God's universal intention works through historical particularity. So in one sense, God does play favorites to bring about his purposes. And we can't complain that God started with this person or this nation or whatever. He's God. He can do what he wants. And he started with Abraham. But the end of his plan is blessing to all nations. Now, I hope you've noticed that in many of these promises, there's echoes of scrub that we talked about in an earlier section. And I hope that you're starting to think the wheels are turning and process how all of this relates to our discussion of scrub. And for this reason, I have created a supplementary video to explain in more depth how the promise of Abraham relates to scrub throughout the Bible, and also to explore how the elements of scrub relate to one another. In other words, how does salvation relate to blessing? How does community interact with the relationship, etc.? So I recommend you check out the other video because it will help you to better understand the biblical big picture and how these things fit together. And also because we won't have time to explore these important issues in this section. Instead, we're going to continue with the story of Abraham in Genesis. In the first three verses, as we've seen, God gives the promise, and in the rest of the story, the promise is tested, confirmed, and eventually fulfilled. In chapter 13, Abram is contrasted with his nephew Lot. They go their separate ways, Lot choosing what he thought was the better destiny, but the promise and the blessing goes with Abram. And this is confirmed in verses 15 through 17, where God promises all of the land to Abram. And he expands the promise that Abram would have offspring as many as the dust of the earth. And in chapter 14, Abraham walks in the promise and blessing. He helps the kings of the land, and he rescues Lot. And he's blessed by Melchizedek, king of Salem, and priest of God Most High. And the chapter ends with an important demonstration of Abram's character. See, Abram is offered the riches from this military conquest, but he turns them down. And the reason he gives is so that no one will be able to say, I made Abram rich. You see, he knows he will be rich because God has promised, and he ensures that God is the one who gets the credit. And then chapter 15, like chapter 12, is a very important chapter, because in this chapter, God renews the promise, Abraham demonstrates his trust, and then God initiates his covenant with Abraham. The chapter begins with God renewing and elaborating on his promise to Abram. He said, "Do not be afraid. I am your shield, your very great reward." Notice that, ignoring the chapter break, that Abram has just turned down the offer of riches from the kings, and then almost next verse, God says, "I am your reward." You know, talk about holding out for a better deal. But Abram brings up his childless state. He says, basically, your blessing is great, but it's going to end when I die. And God responded by assuring him that a child from his own body would be his heir. And not only that, he took him outside, drew his attention to the stars in the sky, and promised that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars. And Abraham believed the Lord, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Genesis 15:6 is one of the most important verses in the Bible, and it's quoted in the New Testament as such. And it was not the quality or the strength of Abraham's faith, but it was the object of his faith that mattered. He trusted God, and God graciously considered him to be on the right side. And God responded in verse 7 with a very important phrase. Read it carefully. The next thing he said is, "I am Yahweh." Hopefully that should ring some bells. He reminded Abram that he took him out of his hometown Ur, and he reiterated that he is giving him the promised land as his possession. But then Abram asked God how he could know that he will possess the land. And God responds by commanding a ritual, which might seem strange to us, but it totally made sense in their time and culture. See, he made Abram cut animals in half and arrange them in two rows. What's going on with this? Well, this is actually part of a covenant ceremony. Remember, we've defined a covenant as a solemn commitment to a person, kind of similar to a marriage in current terms. And just like in a modern marriage, in those days, there were rituals and ceremonies to enter a covenant relationship. And in this particular ceremony, the slaughtered animals would be arranged in two rows. And as part of the ritual, the two covenant partners would walk together down the row between them, down this pathway of death. And the symbolism of this was saying that each of the two parties, they were swearing that they would become like these animals if they ever broke the covenant. In other words, they're saying, "May this happen to me if I'm ever unfaithful." It's a very graphic way to swear an oath of covenant loyalty. So Abram asked how he would know, and God set up an oath ceremony. God told Abram in detail what would happen to his descendants, and he reiterated his promise that they would inherit the land. And then God's presence, symbolized by a burning torch, walked down the line. And he did it alone. Instead of typically the two parties walking together, God did it by himself. See, in response to Abram's question, God unilaterally promised an oath to do all that he had said with a typical covenant formula. And in verse 18, it says that the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. Then in chapter 16, Abram tries to help the promise. See, Abram was childless because his wife was barren. Therefore, he and his wife conspired that he would have a child with their female slave whose name was Hagar. And so Hagar became pregnant and gave birth to Abram's first son. They named him Ishmael. Then in chapter 17, God repeated his promise and confirms his covenant with Abram. This is when Abram was 99 years old and his wife was around 90. God appeared to him again. He said, "I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, be holy. I will confirm my covenant between me and you, and I will greatly increase your numbers." And God changed Abram's name to Abraham, and I know I've been using them interchangeably up to this time. The name Abram means exalted father, but the name Abraham means father of many. Remember, he still doesn't have any kids with his wife, Sarah. And he changed his wife's name to Sarah, which means princess. And God elaborated and confirmed the terms of his covenant. First, he specified that this covenant is not just for Abraham, but also for his descendants after him. Next, he required Abram and all the males in his family to be circumcised as a sign of this covenant. And God clearly specified that Sarah would have a son, and her descendants would be the bearers of the promise, and they would actually be kings. Abraham doubted and he laughed because obviously he and his wife were too old for kids. And Abraham suggested again, "Well, can't you just do this with Ishmael?" But God insisted that the covenant and the blessing will be with Sarah's son, not with Hagar's son, Ishmael. You see, God doesn't need Abraham's help to fulfill his promises. He's God. God chose to make the covenant with only one of Abraham's sons through Sarah. Now, God was good to Ishmael, but he chose Isaac as the one to fulfill his plan, in contrast to Ishmael. Then in chapter 18, God repeats his promise and makes himself known to Abraham. He tells them again, within a year, you're going to have a son. And then he does not hide from Abraham what he is doing, that he's about to destroy Sodom. In other words, he brings Abraham into his confidence in his plan. He makes himself known to Abraham and even allows Abraham to question his actions and inquire about his character. Abraham asks him, "Won't the judge of all the earth do right? Will you destroy the city if there's righteous people in it? If there's 50 righteous people, will you destroy Sodom?" And God said no. And this demonstrates God is just and also merciful. But then Abram bargains down to 40. What about 40? What about 30? What about 20? And finally 10 righteous people. And each time God agrees, "No, if there's 10, I won't destroy the city." And notice in this story, in this bargaining, that God does not stop saying yes to a lower and lower number until Abraham stopped asking. What would have happened if Abram would have asked, what about 5, 4, 3, 2, 1? We have not yet found the end of God's mercy. And yet his mercy was exercised at the same time he upheld his righteous justice. And we see that in chapter 19, where God did destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah for their extraordinary wickedness. But in his mercy, he rescued Abraham's nephew Lot and his family, from whom then came the Moabites and the Ammonites. And all three of the innocent people that were in Sodom were spared, just along the lines that Abraham was asking. And these episodes, they contrast Sodom, Lot, Moab, and Ammon as people who were not the focus of God's blessing, promise, and covenant. In chapter 20, Abraham wavers in his faith, yet God still protects him and the promise, and God even causes him to prosper materially through this chapter. Then, finally in chapter 21, the promise is partly fulfilled by the birth of Isaac. And Isaac is contrasted with Ishmael, who is then sent away from Abraham's family. Because God insisted, the blessing will be fulfilled through Isaac, the child of promise. And Abraham prospers more and more. Part of the promise is fulfilled. It's not all fulfilled yet, but it's starting. Then in chapter 22, the promise is tested in a big way. Now, as you read this, notice there's many parallels in this chapter with the initial promise in chapter 12. At the beginning of this chapter, God asks Abraham, take your son Isaac to the certain place I'll show you and kill him as a sacrifice. You see the problem for the story here? If Abraham obeys and Isaac dies, what happens to the promise and the blessing? Now, don't worry. God knew all along what he's going to do. But he wanted to reveal himself to Abraham through this very difficult lesson. And Abraham did respond well with trust. And he didn't sacrifice Isaac. God stepped in. And the punchline of this whole story is that God is the one who will provide. God is the one who brings about his promises, with, without, and even in spite of our help. See, any promise we could do on our own is not worth it. God provides the sacrifice in this episode, so God alone is glorified. God's promise comes about by his grace through faith and not because of our works. And in this chapter, God renewed again his promise to Abraham and his descendants. This then brings us to the story of Isaac. Isaac, Abraham's son, is actually a bit of a minor player in Genesis. He's contrasted with Ishmael, as we've already seen. And Ishmael gets a Toledot formula and a genealogy later in chapter 25. But in chapter 24, Abraham sends to search for a wife for Isaac because he does not want him to intermix with the ungodly Canaanites. And prayer plays a key part in this story of finding a wife for Isaac. And this is kind of the ideal we're modeled to find God's provision and will through prayer. God leads and provides, and Rebekah eventually marries Isaac to carry on the promise through their descendants. And in chapters 25 and 26, the promise is confirmed to Isaac, and Isaac walks in the ways of Abraham. Chapter 26, starting in verse 24, says, "The Lord appeared to Isaac, and he said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will bless you and will increase the number of your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. Isaac built an altar and called on the name of Yahweh. There he pitched his tent. You hear the echoes of the promise to Abraham now being reiterated to his son Isaac. And then this section ends with the death of Abraham. Next, we see the story of Jacob. It starts with the Toledot formula, and then Jacob is contrasted with his twin brother Esau. The promise is through Jacob, not Esau. And this is based on God's choice, not the natural birthright order, because Esau was born first. And it's not because of anything that they did, because God announced this choice before they were even born. And we see that Jacob, through this story, he lacks character. He's a trickster. He tries to get the promise by his own strength and his own guile. He conned the birthright from his brother in chapter 25. He stole his father's blessing by guile in chapter 27. And actually, because of these underhanded ways, he ends up fleeing the country from his brother Esau, who wants to kill him. But just before he crosses the border, leaving the promised land, going back to Mesopotamia, God appears to him in a dream, and he receives a renewed promise from God. And this is the beginning of the hint of Jacob's conversion. See, God renews his promises that he'd given to Abraham, he'd given to Isaac, and now he's given them to Jacob. Genesis 28, starting at verse 13, says, "There, above the ladder to heaven, stood the Lord, and he said, I am Yahweh, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land in which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to the land, and I will not leave you until I have done what I've promised you." Now, do you hear all the echoes of the same promise that God gave Abraham in this promise to his grandson Jacob? Then once in Mesopotamia, Jacob meets Abraham's relative Laban and Laban's two daughters, Rachel and Leah. And Jacob falls madly in love with Rachel, and he promises to work 7 years for her hand in marriage. And at the end of the 7 years, the trickster is tricked. He gets deceived in the same way that he deceived his father, and he ends up with Leah, the ugly sister, instead of Rachel, the one that he wanted. And so he works another 7 years for Rachel. And through all of this, Jacob has 12 sons, a large family. And his 12 sons will father what will later be the 12 tribes of the nation of Israel from their respective descendants. So the promise of a large family is beginning to be fulfilled. Not yet as many as the stars of the sky, but 12 sons is a good start in that direction. And Jacob also starts to prosper materially, helping the promise. And yet, God still blesses him. And then after about 2 decades in Mesopotamia, Jacob returns back to the promised land. And God protects the promise by protecting Jacob from Laban, who wants to harm him by this time. And on the border of the promised land, Jacob wrestles with God and is brought to the end of his own resources and finally submits to God. And God changes Jacob's name from Jacob, which means deceiver, to Israel. And this seems to be the point of Jacob's conversion. And then he meets with his brother Esau, who had wanted to kill him, and Jacob thinks he might still want to kill me. But they had a reconciliation, bit of an uneasy reconciliation. And at the end of this meeting, Jacob lies to Esau and goes his own way. the deceiver is still kind of deceiving. So we're left with a bit of question on Jacob. Has he really converted? And the sons are mixed character. They're not always virtuous. And then this section ends with a Toledot formula and a genealogy of Esau by way of contrast with Jacob. Now, in all of this section, Jacob is far from perfect, but he's walking in God's promise and blessing because God is perfect, not Jacob. And then finally is a story of Joseph, one of Jacob's 12 sons. And remember that intertwined with the Joseph story, there's also a subplot of Judah and his conversion. It starts with another Toledot formula, chapter 37, verse 2. And then continues the legacy of Jacob's dysfunctional family. I mean, some of this stuff you just can't make up. It plays like a soap opera in some respects, but it's all true. Jacob the deceiver is deceived by his sons, and he loses his favorite son, Joseph. Jacob's deceitful ways are bearing fruit, and the promise is tested yet again. Will the promises fail? Well, we'll see. In this section, Joseph is contrasted with his 11 brothers. It starts with Joseph having a dream from God. The dream says that Joseph will rule over all of his brothers. And again, this is out of the normal birth order. Joseph is one of the youngest. But he is his father's favorite. And he's faithful to his father. But Joseph's dream is tested by circumstances. You see, his brothers hate him. And they kidnap him. And they almost kill him, but they sell him into slavery into Egypt. And even in Egypt, he's unjustly accused and he's thrown into jail. And yet God is still with him because this is all part of God's larger plan. Joseph remains faithful and he providentially rises to power in every circumstance. He's put in charge of his master's house. He's given a position of responsibility in the jail. And finally, he's miraculously placed as ruler over all of Egypt. Psalm 105 recounts this episode, starting at verse 17, when it says, in part, God sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. His feet were hurt with fetters, his neck was put in a collar of iron, until what he had said came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. Now, the NIV translates this last verse. Till what he foretold came to pass, till the word of the Lord proved him true. Well, which is it? Is it the word of the Lord tested him or proved him true? Actually, both of these translations are good. Because as we've seen, the promise is tested and the promise is proved true because God is the one who promised. Joseph is radically tested. But in the end, Joseph is vindicated by the word of the Lord. And then while ruling over Egypt, by God's intervention, Joseph prevents a famine and saves all of Egypt and the surrounding countries. And because of this, because of God's plan, his brothers come down to Egypt to get food. And they come face to face with Joseph, the brother that they'd sold into slavery. But they didn't recognize him at the time. They didn't recognize this guy they're dealing with is their lost brother. And Joseph recognized them. And he tested his brothers to see if they would still betray their other younger brother and grieve their father again. And notice in this episode, it's Judah. He's the one that stands up for his younger brother, Benjamin, at great cost to himself, because Judah has converted and taken leadership in the family. And finally, Joseph reveals himself to his brothers, and they are reconciled. And they bring Jacob, their father, with all the family down to Egypt, where they live in privilege because of Joseph's status. Then after a while, when Jacob is near to death, he blesses his sons. Judah and Joseph's two sons, they stand out as the primary recipients of Jacob's blessing. Although it's made clear all 12 sons now are going to share in God's promise, they're all going to be God's people. It's now no longer Jacob, not Esau. It is all 12, with Judah rising a bit to the top. And the hope is that they will all return to the promised land. And this is highlighted. They will. And Jacob dies, and they bury him in the promised land. And Joseph is fully reconciled to his brothers. He assures them that their misdeeds toward him, even though they were fully wicked deeds, they were somehow part of God's working out of his providence to save people and protect the promise. And then Genesis ends with the death of Joseph and the promise of them all eventually returning to the promised land from Egypt. There's a lot that happened in the patriarch's epic, but God has protected his promise, and his people are a growing family dwelling in Egypt, which sets the scene for the Exodus in the next book of the Bible. But for now, let's look at a few theological themes that we've seen throughout this section. The first, hopefully no surprise here, the first is the promise. The promise is graciously given by God to Abraham and his descendants. But the promise is tested. It's not always easy. It's not always automatic. And sometimes it takes a long time. Sometimes it looks like it will fail. But it never does. And the promise is fulfilled gradually. At the end of Genesis, some parts of the promise have been fulfilled, but some are still awaiting fulfillment. Abraham has a son who grows into a large family, but they're not yet a great nation, and they do not yet possess the promised land. And the promise is fulfilled sometimes with Abraham's help, sometimes without his help, and sometimes in spite of his and his descendants' attempts to bring about the promise on their own wisdom and their own strength. And the second theme is election. That is, God chooses some to be the focus and recipients of his promise. And this is by God's choice, not because of any extra value or merit in the person chosen. And they're chosen for blessing, but they're also chosen to be a blessing for others through them. And they're chosen for God's purposes, not for selfish benefit. And the final theme is covenant. A covenant, as we've seen, is a solemn commitment to a person. And in the patriarch story, the covenant is always initiated and secured by God himself. The covenant with Abraham is a unilateral blessing from God. But the covenant does require holiness and obedience from God's people. These are the major theological themes of the patriarch section of Genesis. So now, let's review the four sections of the Genesis patriarchs, which correspond to the four generations of the patriarchs. They are Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, which is also about Judah. And the three theological themes of the patriarchs, they are promise, election, and covenant. Peck, if that helps. Well, that wraps up the patriarch section and the book of Genesis. Remember, there's a supplemental section to elaborate on God's promises of blessing and the working out of scrub. And also in the next regular section, we'll start on the next epic and the next biblical book of the Exodus. I'm looking forward to it, and I hope you are as well. Thanks for watching.